One area where we're failing to make the adequate amount of investments is in education.
We need to think about what is an adequate and reasonable amount for public education.
Democratic candidates for Lieutenant Governor debate the issues. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, using a new method to count polar bear.
The advantage that we see for the satellite imagery is that we don't have to put people in helicopters and fly them over the sea ice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
When voters go to the polls in August, there will be just two statewide primary contests on the ballot. There's the Republican Senate primary, which is attracting national attention and millions of dollars. And then there's the Democratic Lieutenant Governor's race. The two candidates for the Democratic nomination debated today at a lightly attended Anchorage Chamber of Commerce event. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that the pair differed more in style than substance.
From the very beginning, it was clear that there weren't going to be fireworks at the Lieutenant Governor's debate. The event had a capacity of 150, but just over 40 people showed up, and a couple of tables were entirely empty. And then Anchorage Chamber of Commerce President and debate moderator Andrew Halcrow introduced the office of Lieutenant Governor like this.
The Lieutenant Governor's position is commonly referred to as simply watching over the state seal, or waiting for the governor to die.
After State Senator Hollis French and Wasilla teacher and political newcomer Bob Williams established that, yes, serving as lieutenant governor is a worthwhile job, they laid out their positions on everything from energy to education. And over again, their answers echoed each other. They both expressed concern that the state wasn't spending its money on the right things, both calling out the expensive and controversial renovation of the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. And one place where they would like to put more money? Well, here's French.
One area where we're failing to make the adequate amount of investments is in education.
And here's Williams.
We need to think about what is an adequate and reasonable amount for public education.
They support increasing the minimum wage, but they have reservations about allowing the sale of marijuana in the state, even if neither of them think possession of the drug should land someone in jail. Again, here's French.
The ballot initiative, I think, goes too far. It legalizes not only marijuana, but the derivatives and the condensed products, and you wind up with storefronts, and I don't think Alaska's quite ready for that.
And Williams.
That idea of criminalizing and spending a lot of money to put people in prison for recreational drug use, I think is wrong. There's some changes, but I will be voting no.
As far as the new tax ceiling on oil production goes, both French and Williams want to go back to a higher profits tax. If anything, they ended up debating moderator Andrew Halcrow more than each other on the oil tax question, given that the chamber's taken a position against the referendum. Halcrow repeatedly pressed them on their arguments before the business-friendly audience. When it came time to ask each other questions, neither one focused on substantive differences. Williams asked French how he planned to work across the aisle and why he was running for the lieutenant slot after running for governor before. French didn't even ask Williams a combative question, instead asking him to talk about his experience teaching during years of flat funding. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
With sea ice in the Arctic melting, the region's most iconic animal, the polar bear, is in peril. Researchers have monitored the threatened predator for decades, but tracking bears in remote and harsh climates can be costly and dangerous, which is why federal scientists have started using a new tool to study polar bears, satellites. APRN's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
Studying polar bears in the Arctic can be difficult. Scientists rely on boats, helicopters, and low-flying planes, which can't access many remote regions where polar bears live. The U.S. Geological Survey, though, recently started tracking polar bears from space using high-resolution satellites. Todd Atwood works on the project.
The advantage that we see for the satellite imagery is that we don't have to put people in helicopters and fly them over the sea ice. And obviously it is completely non-invasive to polar bears.
Atwood is currently analyzing satellite images from Rowley Island in Canada, where polar bears amass in large numbers during the summer. Researchers have already completed a bear count using the images, which seems to be accurate. As an end goal, Atwood hopes to better understand how the threatened animal is responding to climate change. The new tracking method could also produce information about an animal that's not very well understood, which has Jeff York of Polar Bears International excited.
We lack sufficient data. We lack sufficient information for nearly half of the polar bears' range. I think one thing we need to do straight away is to fill in those blank spots on the map.
York and other researchers are particularly eager to use satellites in the Arctic sea ice, an environment that's rapidly changing. But spotting white polar bears in a sea of snow has its challenges.
It's a great target to shoot for. I just think that technology's not there yet. And you're looking for white on white. That's next to impossible.
More immediately, USGS researchers plan to use polar bear spotting satellites in coastal Alaska and other parts of the Arctic. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a memorial to a Juneau man who was sent to an internment camp during World War II.
I feel it's a wonderful tribute to him and for the community that really helped him out so much.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
A handful of homes in Juneau are cleaning up after a river flooded over the weekend. As KTOO's Matt Miller reports, the unusual event has become a regular, almost expected occurrence in the capital city.
Jökulhlaup is an Icelandic term for glacial outburst flood, and for the past three summers, runoff and glacial melt has pooled in a small valley called Suicide Basin above the terminus of Juneau's Mendenhall Glacier. Then the dam suddenly breaks and the water comes rushing through a channel underneath. But when exactly it happens and how much water is released is always a big mystery. This year's Jökulhlaup happened Wednesday evening, and it took a few days for the water to travel under Mendenhall Glacier into Mendenhall Lake. National Weather Service forecasters expected a discharge of as much as 11 billion gallons and flows reaching 20,000 cubic feet a second, over three times normal, as the lake emptied into Mendenhall River. On Friday afternoon, Mendenhall Lake peaked at a record level of 11.8 feet, and Mendenhall River peaked at 13.5 feet. Those were just shy of projections. The Forest Service closed a campground and popular trails around Mendenhall Glacier. Juneau officials put emergency equipment on standby and prepared for possible closures of a low-lying road or pedestrian access over area bridges. Some homes along the banks of Mendenhall River had water in their backyards, covering vegetation and lapping at their back decks or foundations. CBJ Emergency Services Program Manager Tom Matisse says they thought they had a worst-case scenario developing with lake and river levels projected to crest even higher.
It's important that people recognize that these are models and there's some flexibility in how high it's going to get and how fast it's going to come, and we just have to err on the side of caution and have everybody be prepared. It's great to see the residents like this who are aware of what's going on and really do their best to be prepared for these situations.
Don Habiger's friends from church helped him set up sandbags around the doors to his home, seal up the house's lower vents, and run a pump to get the water out of the crawl space. He and his wife stayed in their house Friday night, even though power to the View Drive neighborhood was turned off.
Even at the height, you could hear water going into the crawl space underneath the stem wall seal plate or whatever they call those things. But we never got it in the house.
Any idea whether or not the foundation might have been compromised from that?
Don't know. We'll do an inspection when it's dry, drier.
At Bob Winter's place, several doors up the street, a bathtub-like ring of spruce and hemlock needles still shows the peak of Friday's flood. about 10 inches of water in the house and 37 inches in the garage, which sits a little lower on his property.
Basically, all the flooring in the house has got to be replaced. Many of the cabinets, a lot of the furniture will have to be replaced. We got the important stuff up off the floor before it happened. And we thought the garage was all taken care of. We put stuff up on tables, and it's never been this high before, but the water was actually up over the top of the tables by a foot. So chainsaws and tools and things like that all got wiped out.
Winter acknowledges that weeks and maybe even months of cleanup and repairs are ahead. It'll be covered by flood insurance. He may put the house up on pilings, but he won't move. He and his wife have been there 30 years. Most trails and recreational facilities around Mendenhall Lake and Mendenhall River were reopened by Saturday afternoon. Matisse says some trees were reported stuck in the pilings of a bridge replacement project further down Mendenhall River. Heavy rainfall over the weekend prompted more flooding on Monday morning. Mendenhall Lake and Mendenhall River levels rose about 2 feet shy of Friday's peak before declining again. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Southeast Alaska entrepreneurs are getting a second chance to win $40,000 to develop regional businesses. It's part of a partnership involving a Native corporation and a conservation group that made its first awards last year. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Petersburg Indian Association has been developing a small compost business. The association's Jason Wilson says it uses local products.
What we do is we take the leftover scraps from Petersburg fisheries. After they process their fish, there's always, you know, heads and carcasses and tails. And we have alder wood chips from just clearing of the roads. So we also have sawdust. And we mix it all together and let it compost, and voila.
The association is one of 12 semifinalists in a program called Path to Prosperity. It's supported by Ha'ani, part of the Sealaska Regional Native Corporation, and the Nature Conservancy. Elena Peterson is Economic Development Coordinator for Ha'ani.
We really are looking for businesses that, you know, want to improve their communities, create jobs, and do so in a way that doesn't deplete resources and that solves existing needs within the community.
Peterson, who's based in Sitka, says the 12 semifinalists were chosen from a pool of 27 applicants. They'll spend the next few months developing their plans. One step is a business boot camp weekend to be held in Juneau during September.
At the boot camp, we connect them with industry professionals that can help them fill in the gaps and try to answer questions that they might have.
The business plans are due in early December, and the two winners will be announced in late January. An online survey will then pick a People's Choice winner. All will receive $40,000 in consulting and technical services. Peterson says the dozen proposals look worthwhile. One, from Kasan, would expand cultural tours in the Haida village on Prince of Wales Island.
Their business idea is really to put together the gift shop and offer a real, like, eco-tourism experience for the independent traveler, so people that want to come in and really experience what it is like to be in Kasan and what type of village it is.
Other semifinalists include a Haines distillery, a Sitka otter fur sewing business, a Petersburg fish processor, and a Juneau coffee shop. Wilson of the Petersburg Indian Association says its compost project is ripe for expansion.
If we make it through, it would be nice to be able to just have a business that was going to be completely sustainable, because we're using all sustainable elements in the product itself. It would be nice just to be able to have a system in place that really just paid for itself, because we're doing a good thing with the environment.
He says the compost is concentrated and dried. That keeps shipping and storage costs low. The business would employ about 2 people at the start, but eventually he'd like to have several more working on the project. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Facing federal budget cuts and continued pressure on 8A contracting, the Calista Regional Native Corporation is continuing to look beyond federal contracts. Calista acquired STG, a major construction company, last year, and is hoping to grow and diversify. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The majority of Calista's revenues come from federal contracts in areas as diverse as aerospace engineering, military range support, and Coast Guard food service.
Company officials say federal budget cuts and sequestration made 2013 a very tough year for seeking and delivering those contracts. Calista's federal holdings saw a decline of 12% in revenues, but the company years ago decided to make a conscious effort to diversify. Calista President and CEO Andrew Guy says they will continue to be very active in contracting.
Federal contracting has too much of an opportunity for us, and the kind of benefits that it returns to our shareholders is proven. So we won't go away from it. We'll just approach it in a smarter way and at the same time diversify away from it.
As a proportion, federal contracts went down slightly last year from 64% to 61% of revenues. Guy says it was close to 80% in recent years. Shareholders recently received a record $4.3 million dividend, reflecting a successful year of operations. The company's revenues actually dropped 8% to $369 million from a high of $402 million in 2012, but net revenues were up. Beyond contracting, about a quarter of Calista's revenues come from the construction business. That area has grown quickly in recent years. Tom Leonard, the communications manager for Calista, says growth is tough as federal budgets have impacted that sector.
A huge portion of the transportation budgets for the state comes from federal monies, and that just trickles down to all the businesses that could do construction.
President Guy says future diversification will come both internally and by looking outside for opportunity.
You know, it's obvious that we can't acquire a company every year. So we have a kind of a long-term strategy to acquire a company every 2 or 3 years.
One area of business that's not making money at this point is the communication sector, which hasn't turned a profit since 2010. That area lost $4.6 million in 2013. One company, Futurus, among its other services, is a partner on a project to connect Alaska with a subsea fiber optic network across the Northwest Passage.
Our board and management obviously won't allow any company to operate indefinitely with losing money year by year by year. And that's why we have a turnaround plan in place for any company that we have right now. We expect our companies, all of our companies, to be profitable or at least break even.
Calista has over 12,000 shareholders. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
After Pearl Harbor was attacked, Juneau's Japanese population was forced from their homes and sent to internment camps in the lower 48. Teenager John Tanaka was among those shipped out. He was the valedictorian of Juneau High School in 1942, but didn't get to graduate with everyone else. An empty wooden chair was put on stage in his place. Now a bronze replica of that chair will remain at the Capitol School Park permanently. The sculpture was dedicated at a memorial to the interned on Saturday. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has the story.
A keyboardist and violinist play a Japanese song in the rain under a tent. Chains made of 1,000 brightly colored origami cranes drape the empty chair memorial. It's a bronze reproduction of a simple folding chair, like the kind Juneau High School used in the 1940s for graduation ceremonies. It has a Spartan look, sequestered in a corner of the park atop a jagged chunk of planked flooring.
And the irregular edge of the floor was intended to represent a section of the gymnasium floor that had just been ripped out of the gymnasium as a metaphor for the way that the people were ripped from their homes and their community.
That's Peter Reiquam, a Seattle-based artist who was commissioned for the Empty Chair Project. The names of the 53 Japanese nationals and Japanese Americans from Southeast Alaska who were forced to leave their homes for government-run internment camps during World War II.
Kichi Henry Akagi, William Akagi, Hikohachi Fukuyama,
are etched into the floor planks. The communal, military-style camps were ringed by barbed wire and guard towers. Mary Tanaka Abo, one of John Tanaka's sisters, tears up during the dedication ceremony. She is surrounded by her extended family and says seeing her young relatives understand what her generation went through is particularly important.
You know, our family history, people kind of roll their eyes, the kids, you know. But, you know, when they see, you know, the community here and they really think it's important, then it kind of validates everything. And, you know, people are nearing the end of their lives. So it's just really tremendous to share this moment, you know, of our hometown with our families.
After being interned, John was drafted into the 442nd Infantry Regiment, a Japanese-American army unit that fought in Europe. His family returned to Juneau after the war. The lease on the family business, the City Cafe, had lapsed, but the community helped the Tanakas and others reestablish themselves. The cafe eventually became a 50-year institution. John worked summers in the cafe while going to college and medical school. He became an anesthesiologist and settled in Spokane, Washington. He died in 1977. His widow, Jean Tanaka, says they rarely talked about their internment or the war, but she says John spoke fondly of his hometown.
I feel it's a wonderful tribute to him and for the community that really helped him out so much, and I'm very grateful.
200 people came out on Saturday for the sculpture's dedication. The youngest descendants of the interned unveiled the sculpture. Each child delivered a chain of the origami cranes to an elder. Most of the Juneau residents sent away during World War II have died, but a few attended the ceremony. 89-year-old Walter Fukuyama was one of the high school students who was detained. After the dedication, he stepped into the gym where he had played basketball as a youth, where he should have graduated in 1943. The hoops are still there, but the space has been converted to makeshift offices for state workers. It was the first time he'd been back. He didn't want to pose for photos and said he wasn't sure how he felt. He said he just wanted to reminisce. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Eating is, by nature, a social activity. But these days, with the frenetic pace of American living and a disturbing reliance on fast food, it's hard to get the whole family together for a meal. Now, a traveling Smithsonian exhibit at the Palmer Museum attempts to get people connected to their local foods. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a sampling of old-time Palmer colonists' recipes is helping to highlight the use of native-grown produce.
What we better do is fortify you with a glass of our lovely vintage punch.
Janet Kincaid presides over a punch bowl on a white cloth-trimmed table spread with sweets made from 1930s recipes. Kincaid owns the Old Colony Inn in Palmer, a vintage building where she's hosting a recipe sampling, most of them made from local produce.
This building was built in 1935 as a dormitory for single teachers and nurses for the colony. They found out that they could not get nurses and teachers to come up here and live in a tent.
Barb Thomas with the Palmer Historical Society and Kincaid came up with the recipe swap idea featured at last weekend's Palmer Midsummer Garden and Art Fair.
I love nutmeg with rhubarb. Anything rhubarb to me needs.
And the swap means I get to take one of those
you
recipes.
You get to taste.
Can I taste? This is your cookies?
Yeah, and you can have the recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the...
Yummy. Very good.
Recipe.
Kincaid directs me to a long table with elaborate place settings for six and explains the proper etiquette in preparing a table for dinner. Even the doughty first colonists in Palmer brought along their sets of china, colorful Depression glass plates, and silverware.
This china is Bavarian china, and it was my mother's who got married in 1930. And in those days, they had silverware that matched. What I think is interesting is how many of the glasses were goblets. You had goblets rather than solid glasses. And many pieces, they used a lot of dishes.
Elegant stemware and a special dessert fork are rarely seen nowadays, but at one time, supper was the glue that drew the family back together at day's end. And a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian traces how American eating habits influenced our society through the years. Selena Ortega Chalero is the director of the Palmer Museum.
Every country has a very clear distinction of what their food is, their native food. But when you think of America, we're such a combination of different cultures, it's really hard to define what American food is. So the Smithsonian did a lot of research. They compiled this wonderful exhibit, and it explores that question, what is American food culture in the United States?
Well, let's step in.
Sure.
Inside the tiny log structure that houses the museum, the key ingredients exhibit literally stretches floor to ceiling. The panels trace American food festivals, think Thanksgiving, from their earliest start in pre-revolutionary times through corn huskings, lobster bakes, and the advent of the Frankfurter, right up to our current eating habits. One thing food trends of the past had in common, they brought people together.
And it explores that idea of sharing food in a more social gathering. So food festivals like state fairs, when they started to commercialize and had restaurants, the whole idea of eating out is considered a special thing, a special occasion event. The exhibit explores that idea as well.
We walk through the exhibit, which is eclectic to say the least. One panel shows the evolution of the roadside diner. There are photos of the Washington Apple Queen and of Indian women grinding corn. Selena says Key Ingredients has special resonance for Palmer because it is a farming community.
It really did start with the fact that we were a fertile land and the fact that we can have a lot of things produced here locally. You know, we're very self-sustaining that way.
She says when mass food production and marketing entered the scene in the 1950s, people were influenced to buy a certain way, leading to eating packaged and frozen foods.
Even though that's what took off because it was convenient and fast, at least here in Alaska, we're now starting to see a return back to eating fresh, eating local.
The Key Ingredients exhibit has traveled state to state, with Alaska its last stop. It'll be at the Palmer Museum until July 20th, then it moves to Talkeetna for its final run. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller, Ed Schoenfeld, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez and Joaquin Palomino reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Join chef and author Stephen Reichlin on his visit to Alaska July 25th through the 27th. Reichlin brings his skills from his shows Barbecue University and Primal Grill for events that include a barbecue salmon cook-off, barbecue class and party, as well as a pig roast over lunch. Let's celebrate summer with Stephen Reichlin and Alaska Public Media, sponsored by Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, the Hotel Captain Cook, and Crush Wine Bar and Bistro, a benefit for Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.